My next guest is certainly well equipped to talk about this. Michael Rubin is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His main area is definitely the Middle East. And Michael, we're glad you could take time out today. I know you're on a conference call later this afternoon and a lot going on. I'm sure you're getting a lot of people calling people like you these days.
Indeed, when it rains, it pours.
Well, it's a fascinating story, number one, and it's certainly an event that has tectonic, you know, forces, not just in Egypt and not just in the Middle East, but around the world. But start by putting Egypt in context for us. Why is Egypt so important to the region?
Well, at its basics, you have to remember that one out of every three Arabs in the Middle East lives in Egypt. It has a population at 80 million people, which is higher than that of Iran or Turkey, which, of course, aren't Arab countries. But Egypt is the largest Arab country and one of the largest Muslim countries on Earth. And so it also has a tremendous importance as a cultural keystone. Cairo, along with Baghdad and Damascus, have always been centers of political culture and political trends, on top of which everyone knows Egypt because Egypt is, if you will, the Hollywood of the Middle East as well.
So many, many aspects. How does Egypt compare with other Middle Eastern nations in terms of modernization, secularization?
Egypt was not as secular as Tunisia. Tunisia was the most secular state in the region. Egypt likes to pretend when it's facing the West that it truly is a secular society, but the Muslim Brotherhood have always been strong. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood were founded in Egypt, on top of which, after that tremendous violence back in the early and mid-1990s, when the Muslim Brotherhood really took to the streets, started killing a lot of non-Muslims and also Muslims who opposed them, after the government cracked down and really crushed at least the militant wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, what you ended up having was Hosni Mubarak's regime try to co-opt the religious sphere. So in one famous example, you had a professor, an Egyptian professor, who was sued by a cleric for being too reformist when it came to Islam. The secular court in Egypt found that this professor could no longer be considered a Muslim, on top of which it then said, well, because he's married to a Muslim woman and he's no longer a Muslim, we're going to forcibly divorce him. This wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood doing this. This was Hosni Mubarak's regime trying to throw a bone to the Islamists.
So how would you rate the power of the Muslim Brotherhood in particular and Islamists more broadly? Because much of the discussion, and I think it was Mohammed Al-Baradei yesterday on CNN, saying that, yes, the Muslim Brotherhood is an important force, but that it still represents a minority of population and viewpoints. Not that he was trying to put them down, right? And he also, I think, tried to portray them in a seemed to me, in a less threatening and more favorable light.
Well, he's trying to build a broad coalition, so that's why he's describing them that way. Certainly, they're not a monolith. Some of them tend to be a little bit more militant. Some of them aren't. Your previous guest, Edward Derigian, gave a speech, I think back in 1992, in the context of Algeria, where he warned that what we have to avoid is one man, one vote, one time. And what's not certain is whether the Muslim Brotherhood, if elected openly, would consent to follow-up elections which weren't based on an Islamist constitution. Now, when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, we have to be very careful not to fall into the propaganda trap of 30 years of Hosni Mubarak's statements, because to paraphrase Saadeddin Ibrahim, the Egyptian-American sociologist, in the Middle East, you often have autocrats who, like Hosni Mubarak, who use the mechanisms of state to promote their views. On the other hand, you have theocrats who use the mosque to promote their views. Both use the other to recruit, out of fear of the other. Hosni Mubarak has demonized the Muslim Brotherhood for so long, we have to make sure that the Muslim Brotherhood, in actuality, might not be what Hosni Mubarak said. I doubt, however, that they really have more than 20 to 25% of the population, because many Egyptians see a different way forward.
What happens next in Egypt?
A few things. First of all, worst case scenario, in my opinion, would still be the Muslim Brotherhood really taking over to the exclusion of others. What I think will happen, however, is at some point the army is going to step in. Even though Hosni Mubarak comes from the army, he's antagonized the army because he tried to force his son as his successor, which was something the army didn't like. When the army steps in, you will have a situation of a transitional government until the September 2011 elections. While the Americans have been on the sidelines now, what will be expected of the United States then is to really make sure that the transitional elections, the transitional government lasts only until September 2011 and isn't the Middle Eastern-style transitional government that lasts decades. The other aspect I think we'll see in the next few days are calls for the repatriation of the sum of $25 billion, which Hosni Mubarak is alleged to have accumulated. That could become a populist position for the Muslim Brotherhood that could allow them to rally people to their side, much like Khomeini was able to rally people to his side by demanding the return of the Shah's assets.
What is your sense? When I watch what we have seen from Egypt and read, it doesn't seem, for the most part, but again, we're just getting snippets, that the people are like dying for blood. In fact, if anything, it seems to be a lot of the view is, please, Mubarak, just go. You know, we don't want violence. We don't want Egyptians shooting Egyptians.
Well, indeed, that's the sense I get. But I would differ with Edward Derigian a little bit when he said this isn't necessarily like the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Frankly, the Islamic Revolution in Iran wasn't like the Islamic Revolution for weeks and months. Remember, when the U.S. Embassy was taken in Tehran, that was 9 months after Ayatollah Khomeini had returned. And so things could still go wrong. It's a very, very delicate situation, and there's lots of opportunities for people to lash out at external actors in order to rally people to their side. But you're absolutely right. Right now, this is a spontaneous economic protest. People are sick and tired of the corruption and the nepotism with which they've suffered for the last 30 years. If I may give one anecdote, I went to Hosni Mubarak's political party convention in 2006, and when members of his own party got up to complain about problems with housing, problems with potable water, and so forth, their microphones were cut off. If that's going on inside the ruling party, you can imagine what it's like when you're not privileged enough to be in the party.
Follow on that. Why now? Why the Egypt uprising now? Is it the demonstration effect from Tunisia? Is it the economy?
Egypt was a tinderbox, and Tunisia provided the spark. And a lot of people looked at President Ben Ali in Tunisia, who was one of the harshest dictators in the Middle East, and figured that if he could be forced out within a matter of less than a month, then it could happen here. And that effect is going to be amplified greatly, exponentially, I think, if Egypt goes, again, because as we were saying before, how crucial Egypt is in the Arab world.
Michael, that Karen mentioned what's going on at the airport in Cairo. You, too, have some concerns about everyone getting out who needs to and wants to.
Well, I just got off 2 weeks on the USS Enterprise, the aircraft carrier and its battle group, as it was heading to the Mediterranean on a previously scheduled deployment. But one of the big contingency concerns for the U.S. Navy, of course, is how to evacuate people. Now, when I deployed was when Lebanon was starting to get dicey, and I was surprised. There's 68,000 Americans in Lebanon. Granted, many of those are Lebanese Americans. In Egypt, the true number would even be higher. Now, many people are trying to get out through the Cairo airport, but there comes a time when, first of all, if violence does really break out in Egypt, uncontrolled violence, the airport might be closed down. Second of all, you have the airplanes and the airline companies, which, while they want to be helpful and want to get people out, if their insurance companies say, we're not going to insure you to fly here, then they have no choice but to stop. In which case, the question I would have is, does the United States have enough forces in the region to evacuate the Americans who are in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Lebanon, with all these crises starting to happen simultaneously?
Well, it could be very challenging.
That is the understatement of the year.
What happens? What's the ramifications of things getting messier? I mean, does it draw us in inadvertently to the conflict if we have stranded Americans that we have to try to get? Is it just like tough luck? You were in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Seldom is it ever tough luck, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Usually the American military will come in one aspect or another, but there's a difference between a limited operation like that and a broader operation that would really get us entangled into affairs. The only way that the Americans are really going to get entangled into affairs is if some new government and a hostile government arises in Egypt, which tries to close off the Suez Canal to international shipping. But I think that even with a hostile government in Egypt, that would be amazingly unlikely, only because of the revenue which the Egyptian government derives from the Suez Canal.
Well, it will be very interesting to see who does prevail, because if there, certainly that would be, you would think that would be the U.S. position quietly behind the scenes. We'll work for whoever comes into power. But remember, all the agreements that were in place with Mubarak are very, still remain very important to us. And we give Egypt, we give you a lot of money, right? So it seemed that's a big bargaining chip for the U.S.
Well, the money which we give to Egypt is predicated on the fact that Egypt made peace with Israel. If for any reason Egypt were ever to abrogate its peace with Israel, it would immediately lose about $1.5 billion a year. And it's kind of interesting. Again, when I was at the 2006 National Democratic Party Convention, that's Hosni Mubarak's political party, this occurred in the wake of the summer war between Israel and Hezbollah, and many independents and many party members were demanding that Egypt break its relations with Israel because of the war with Hezbollah. But ultimately, the Egyptian government chose not to, and I would suspect that they would think long and hard before. It's one thing, it's the most difficult thing is to make peace, but it's also quite difficult to go the extra step and gratuitously sever the peace, especially when you can just suspend it or have a cold peace, which is what Hosni Mubarak has had for the last many years.
How much of this is generational in Egypt? How much of this has been facilitated by the fact that, you know, everybody's got cell phones now, and there's this other kind of communication that so many diverse people in a country, in a region, can deal with each other?
The answer to that is yes and yes. A lot of it is generational. Hosni Mubarak, even if he were to retain power, I think I'm on pretty safe ground saying that octogenarian dictators tend not to live that long. And so ultimately, change is coming to Egypt anyway. This is why he was trying to pass off power to his son. The growth rate and the demographic rate in Egypt is, I think, offhand, I don't have the stats in front of me, I think it's over 2%, whereas the United States is 0.97. The fact of the matter is the young people are dominant in Egypt, and there's very little opportunity for them. And add cell phones to the mix, it's a truly noxious mix. And despite the geographical size of Egypt, remember that 90% of the population is crammed together in the very narrow Nile River Valley. The rich actually live on islands of affluence within these urban slums, so that walking around the streets of Cairo, especially poor neighborhoods, it's not impossible to see off in the distance a fabulous mansion with heliports on top of the roof and so forth. And so people not only have the feeling of being dispossessed and not having an opportunity, but at the same time seeing what the haves have shoved right in their face.
What is the economic hope of Egypt? Because no matter who gets power, you got, you know, lots of poor people, an economy that's, that's dependent on tourism, the Suez Canal. What can they do? What is the challenge going to be?
Well, oil is minimal. The challenge is going to be taking advantage of Egypt's greatest asset, which is its large population. We could help Egypt certainly with free trade in this regard by diminishing some of the agricultural subsidies we give Americans so that the Egyptian farmers can also compete. And that's a complaint you oftentimes hear inside Egypt. Of course, that brings in a whole host of domestic American politics, which aren't my forte. Also within Egypt, you have the fact that under Mubarak, whenever anyone started to make money, they would be co-opted by a member of the Mubarak family or the elite, the guys that fled on the private jets yesterday. So there's a feeling that if you started to be successful, someone would stop you.
And so that could change, and that could help a lot, too.
Indeed.
Well, I'm an optimist, so I hope all of this turns out to the Egyptians' favor and to everyone's. Michael Rubin, I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for joining us today on the Hayes Advantage, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.